Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening and welcome to the program for Friday, February 27th, 2015. It's the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. And this week, the two experts counting down the most important federal news stories of the week are Anil Carmel, CEO of C2 Labs, and the former Deputy Chief Technology Officer at the National Nuclear Security Administration. Anil, welcome back to the program. It's good to see you, my friend.
Great to see you as well.
Thanks for coming on. And my other expert this week is David Alla, Principal at Catalyst Partners. David, it's good to see you.
Francis, great to be here.
And we had, last time you were here, we were talking before we went on the air, we had a little bet going on our show. I mean, it was a friendly thing, so I don't want to get in trouble with anybody. But you were on with Dan Chenick. And refresh my memory about what we bet on. This was back in, I want to say, October or November.
It was back in October, and you made an offer to buy the lunch of the person who was the closest to the date that the CR would run out that would fund the government past the election.
Uh-huh. And you got the closest,
So we did lunch.
And now the three of us are have a thing going that you suggested, I think, a month or so ago.
Right.
About what would happen with DHS. And it appears, if the chain of events play out as they appear to be playing out, and we'll talk about that later in the program, of course, but it appears that I'm in pretty good shape as far as it looks right now.
You're sitting pretty right now, but as with most things on Capitol Hill, things can change
very quickly. That's exactly right. But I do love me the idea of some free lunch, so we'll get to that later in the program. Anil, it's great to have you back on, and we'll start where we always do with...
Number three!
And your choice at number three is from NextGov, Anil. The headline is, "In the near future, your face will be your ID." My first reaction to the headline was, wow, that's pretty wild. And then my second thought was, well, given where we are with using eyeballs as ID, retina recognition, this seems like the next logical progression. Is the truth kind of somewhere in between?
It is, and it's a little fuzzy in that regard, in the sense that, you know, when you think about the way that we have managed security today, leveraging passwords, right? It's probably one of the most insecure methods that you can possibly think of to authenticate to systems that control, for example, your financial information or your healthcare information, because, you know, we have so many passwords to remember. People resort to the lowest common denominator, right? A sticky note or something simple that you remember. And we have password managers and things along those lines to make it easier. But in the reality is, you know, you need something that is something that allows you to leverage the things that we have today, right? Whereas your fingerprints or your face or ID, you know, or retina, as you just mentioned, right? To authenticate to these systems. So in this particular article, they talk about the fact that, you know, this is something that could be leveraged by many different types of individuals, specifically in this particular case, police officers, to catch bad guys, which from that perspective brings up some very interesting privacy implications, actually.
The technology driving this stuff is the kind of thing that even 5 years ago, we only really thought about in movies, I think. This story says the California-based firm Face First builds software that uses more than 16,000 data points, like the distance between eyes, to identify an individual. And it wasn't that long ago that it just wouldn't have been possible to collect all of that information and analyze it in any kind of a practical time frame for this type of application, I suppose.
That's exactly right. Yeah, so the technology has evolved to a great extent, greatly based on the power of Moore's Law, which has allowed the back-end information systems to progress to the point of where you've got the power of cloud coupled with big data and analytics engines that can take those, in this case, 16,000 data points and quickly turn them into some actionable intelligence to allow folks to act on that information.
You mentioned Moore's Law, which is about computing power. Are there analogs to that when it comes to data analysis or any of the other technology issues that we're dealing with today, where we can, maybe it's not the same progression, but we can identify a progression into how these arcs look, or are they kind of all over the map?
I think we're definitely seeing that. You're seeing a lot of move from reactive type approaches to predictive approaches, right? Which is where, you know, a lot of investments are being made at a government level to do this predictive analytics to predict what, you know, an individual or an adversary may do. So you are seeing maybe not a direct analog, but an indirect analog to the progression of this technology.
And Neil Carmel's choice as the third most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov. The headline, in the near future, your face will be your ID. Dave, your choice at number three is from Bloomberg, and the headline is what you need to know about the net neutrality decision. I've seen a number of different primers about net neutrality because it's like a lot of issues in Washington today. It seems to mean very different things to different people, and it depends. Some of it depends on ideology. Some of it depends on your life, what you do for a living, and there are many other factors that impact how you might see this.
It is Alice in Wonderland in that respect, that words mean whatever you want them to mean. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of rhetoric that's wrapped around how the FCC got to the point where it was yesterday when it announced the decision. I think the main thing is that it is the first time a federal government agency has come out and said as a matter of regulatory policy that this is how we're going to regulate the internet. Under Title II, which 2 years ago was deemed to be a very long shot regulatory approach, but with a significant amount of social media pressure, with the White House weighing in as they did, this is an area where it appears that the big moneyed interests, the ISPs, the AT&Ts, Verizons, and others, were not able to prevail in a regulatory framework. This is not the last we will have heard of the issue. There will be a lot of congressional hearings. The rhetoric has already started. I even saw one headline today said that net neutrality is the equivalent on the communications world that Obamacare was on health insurance. I, again, think that's way out in the extreme. But if you think about, Francis, the license that this radio station has, it was granted based originally on the 1934 Communications Act, before that the 27 Radio Act, which said there is a limited spectrum, and so we're going to operate it in the public interest, and you're going to have to meet certain standards in order to get renewed. In a sense, that is a little bit what the FCC is saying, what Commissioner Wheeler has said, is that there is limited bandwidth. And it is very precious, and we're going to operate it in the public interest instead of letting the private sector have complete free reign. Now, there will be lots of pictures that will be drawn. People think, when you think of surface transportation, the way to increase throughput on the roads is build toll roads where people are able to pay based on variable pricing so they can maintain their speed, and the more they pay, the faster they can go, as a rule. On the information superhighway, however, the FCC has said, nope, that's not the policy we're going to follow. It's not the model that we have, and came out with the rules yesterday. And I think it will impact things down the road for every federal agency, every individual that works in a connected world.
We'll talk more about this later in the program because you're not the only person, David, that thinks that this is important this week. Bloomberg's story is what you need to know about the net neutrality decision is David Olive's choice for the third most important federal news story of the week. And you can find all the stories that we're talking about on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week on In Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, it's David Olive and Anil Carmel, and we're up to...
Number two!
And the second most important federal news story of the week, according to David Olive, is from the Daily Beast. The headline is, third U.S. official hit with child sex and porn charges. It's an ugly, terrible, awful story. Why do you think this is important this week, Dave, given what else is going on in town?
Francis, I have no idea about the merits of this charge. Mm-hmm. The person that was charged was the head of counterterrorism for the State Department, alleged to have engaged in solicitation of a minor through using online communications. That person turned out to be a Fairfax County police official. So whether the charges are real or not, whether he is guilty of anything or not, is not what made this an important story to me. What made it an important story was, given the position that he was in, I believe this will rekindle the background investigation effort that died off and was slowed down last year, and will cause people on the Hill and at OPM, certainly at the State Department, to look at more frequent vetting, more frequent background checks, whether it's continuous vetting or whatever the term of art you want to use. It's an incident like this that will take that issue affecting every single federal employee and contractor with a security clearance and put it back up at the top of the list.
You worked in an environment where security was the absolute utmost, probably among the toughest in government at the National Nuclear Security Administration, Anil. When you see stories like this and think about the security implications of them, the ways that the system could be improved, and all those kinds of things, what do you see in something like this?
Well, I mean, there's definitely an inherent trust that's placed in a government employee. In our particular circumstance, in my former role, safeguarding America's nuclear weapons. So given that public trust that is incumbent upon someone that is in a public servant role, you know, there needs to be an appropriate set of checks and balances, right, where situations like this should not occur, right? So, you know, we've got this clearance system that we have in place today that goes and validates individuals' backgrounds and applies a clearance to access specific sensitive information, right? So, you know, now taking that clearance system and looking at how people are acting in their personal lives, and we have those right checks and balances for those that have clearances for, you know, giving up that level of privacy to ensure that what you're doing in your personal life doesn't impact government information. That check and balance is in there, right? But as you move up the chain in terms of authority and scope, there probably needs to be an additional set of checks and balances put into play that ensures that situations like this don't happen, mm-hmm. right? And that comes into finding that right balance between security and privacy, especially for a person with public trust.
Is that balance, is that line that Anil's talking about going to be, I imagine it's going to be pretty difficult to find that, Dave.
I think it's... certainly going to be difficult to find it or define it in all situations. Clearly, you will have different levels of or different areas where that line is drawn depending on the area of responsibility. In the case of Mr. Rosen, he is the head of counterterrorism at the U.S. State Department. There are probably very few areas in government where someone would be in a position that deals with foreign enemies encountering the threats that they pose. So I think it raises questions about the frequency of those checks. In my mind, it's also going to raise questions about, when did Fairfax County Police know it? When did they share that information with diplomatic security at the State Department or the FBI or others? When they did, what actions were taken? So it's, what did you know and when did you know it, mm-hmm. type of question. It starts off as a local crime. It may have much broader implications. That's why I thought it was an important story.
And David, I think you keyed in on a very important point, information sharing.
Right.
Right. Wherein, you know, you have state and local officials that have access to pertinent information that may not be shared with federal folks and vice versa. That information sharing across state, local, and federal help paint a appropriate picture of what that who that individual is and what they're accessing and what they are into or not into. And that's probably that additional check and balance that probably needs to be put in place in terms of having a good modicum of information sharing across all three of those officials, right, so that everyone can make a risk-rated decision around how to act appropriately.
And those channels exist already. I mean, that's not something we'd have to go out and build. It's just a matter of it sounds like it's a matter of just turning on the access.
The channels exist, mm-hmm. but the type of information that's exchanged isn't necessarily completely broad. So there's congestion in that channel. It's uh-huh. just strictly, you know, very, very high level information. So in this particular issue, what was the missing common denominator? Context.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right. So without that context of, okay, this individual is being charged with, you know, something that, you know, is, you know, in this particular case, child sex and porn charges, you know, at those allegations, without the context of knowing what this person worked in or, you know, what their background was, there's no way to tie the two together. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's the piece, that context piece is the missing critical ingredient.
The culture, Francis, of maybe not having a charge filed against him, but merely opening an investigation. At what point do you disclose that? Because part of the information sharing dilemma from state and local officials is that federal law enforcement agencies will have open investigations on things and never share them at the state or local level because it hasn't gone to the point yet where they're ready to file a charge.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, the fulcrum certainly shifts, the line changes, but this bears much further inquiry, and I likely think that it will get it simply because the nature of the position that this individual held.
What do you think is the solution? Is it a policy solution? Is it a procedure solution? Is it a cultural solution that would drive that information sharing?
Your friend Dale Myros has been on this program many times, is the first one who taught me that the biggest issue in information sharing is changing the mindset from need to know to need to share.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a marvelous bumper sticker. But that takes an understanding and a relationship that people have with each other so they can build the trust that Anil talked about. And you cannot do that with an executive order or an act of Congress. That is going to require one-on-one working together in a level of trust that we don't see today, at least in the public arena. And I think that people are going to start asking questions about why we don't have more of.
David Olive's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is from the Daily Beast, third U.S. official hit with child sex and porn charges. Anil, your choice at number two this week is my colleague Jared Serbu's story headlined Administration's Cyber Sharing Proposal, a Policy Puzzle, Not a Panacea. I'm not sure it's ever good publicity to have something, have a new initiative described as a policy puzzle.
True, very true. It's definitely a step in the right direction in that you know, it's really opening up the lens of sharing information, which is piggybacking on David's number two story, across private sector and public sector. The big question is, how do we do it correctly?
Mm-hmm.
Right. This is the right step. It's the right step to set up these new information sharing and analysis organizations that are privately operated. Right. But how do we do so effectively and get the information that's sitting in a private company's hands to public and vice versa to enable us to better defend the information, both private and public, that we're entrusted to protect?
Is the biggest problem here still getting private sector companies to reveal information about the threats that they've seen? Or is there something else now that's kind of superseded that, given all of the very high-profile private sector hacks that we've heard about?
I think there is still a reluctance on the part of many private sector companies to share information very early on until they can do some authentication work and know for sure what they're dealing with. Liability protection is a major issue for mm-hmm. most private sector companies. On the other side, there's also the reluctance on the part of the federal officials to share what is either classified information or law enforcement sensitive information. The president's executive order attempts to address that by creating these so-called ISALs, the information sharing organizations, But we already have a subset of those iCells known as iSACs, some 16 or 17. There's now one being stood up for automobiles and the Internet of Things and the Google cars and the like. Mm-hmm. And most federal agencies that deal with cyber threats to the Internet of Things hardware are still not comfortable knowing who to talk to and who they can trust.
How far are we away, do you think, from the concept of liability protection that's concrete? The insurance companies, I've heard, are starting to figure out how to price it. So it's not so much an issue that you can't get or that nobody will provide that kind of coverage, but there are other obstacles, it seems.
There are definitely other obstacles. You know, one of the obstacles that we have is, you know, today's company is not national, it's international. So given the fact that, you know, companies like, for example, Sony, which have a global presence that was recently compromised, mm-hmm. right? If they're sharing information with the U.S. government, what information should they share, right? Because their stakeholders and their shareholders are not just U.S. stakeholders and shareholders that are international,
mm-hmm.
right? So understanding what that liability protection is usually applies to U.S. companies. So how do you apply that privacy lens across an international company? How does that company share information with the U.S. government and take away private information that is personally identifiable, right? So I think we are a bit of a ways away in terms of identifying what that true liability protection is in a global context.
Mm-hmm. Francis, and even as the insurance companies are looking at cyber insurance to promote information sharing of the right type of information, the majority of the damages that occur in a cyber breach are not physical damage mm-hmm. as much as it's reputational.
Mm-hmm.
And I have yet to see a cyber insurance policy that fully addresses the reputational damage. There was not a lot of physical damage done in the Target breach. There was much more significant damage done in the Sony breach, mm-hmm. Where they actually destroyed equipment. Mm-hmm. But the big number is the reputational damage, and that's the one people are going to have to address, in my judgment.
And Neil Carmel's choice as the second most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. It's Jared Serbu's story headlined Administration Cyber Sharing Proposal, a Policy Puzzle, Not a Panacea. You can find it and all of our stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week as selected by David Olive and Neil Carmel on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, and we are up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Anil Carmel, is from Storify, and what's the original source on this? This is the net neutrality vote that we have seen coming, and they kind of took a step by step on this. This is a pretty interesting way to present this information that I hadn't seen before. Ultimately, though, we talked about it earlier, of course, because it's David's number three story. The ultimate question about net neutrality, Anil, is how this affects the individual consumer, because as we talked about it off the air, mm-hmm. Whoever winds up paying, ultimately the consumer winds up paying. It's just a matter of how that person winds up, where the money has to go through all the channels to eventually have it hit the consumer in the pocketbook. Am I seeing it the way that we should expect this to turn out?
Yeah. So in essence, there are winners and losers mm-hmm. in every situation. So in this particular case, the winners in the context are the little guys, the consumers, and the small startups that come up with innovative business models to deliver content and information to that consumer, right? The losers in this case are the internet service providers who have a significant investment in delivering a pipe to that last mile your home, right? So given that the size of that pipe is limited and the amount of information that needs to traverse that, you've got your content providers like Netflix and Amazon and whatnot that take a significant amount of bandwidth as compared to traditional email, right? When you look at net neutrality, if the vote went the other way, those big content providers would have to pay a premium to get a special access lane, and they pay that premium to the internet service providers, mm-hmm. right? And if they didn't pay that premium, that content would be congested, mm-hmm. right? So the consumer is the ultimate winner here, because at the end of the day, you know, content like that you generate yourself, YouTube, right, for example, content that you stream yourself, no longer would be subject to segregation being put into the internet access slow lane. Mm-hmm. Every lane is an equal lane.
So what I'm not sure I get is the difference between this, the idea you're talking about, which essentially would require a pay for play. Mm-hmm. If I want to use a whole bunch of Netflix bandwidth, I'm going to either have to subscribe to a faster connection or a fatter pipe or whatever. And what I do with my cell phone. Mm-hmm. You know, we buy, we have a family plan where we get, I think it's 10 gigabytes of data a month, mm-hmm. or something like that. If that's not enough, then I either pay the overage, mm-hmm. or I decide we're going to use that on an ongoing basis and I should just sign up for whatever the next level of services that mm-hmm. is. How is this different?
Yeah, so...
Because I don't mind paying for what I use, and I'm not sure that it's fair to make you pay more to subsidize the use that I do if it turns out you only use 1 gigabyte a month. If you only watch one Netflix movie a month or zero, and I watch 30, I'm not sure I see the reason why we should pay the same bill.
Yeah, and you wouldn't pay the same bill, right? So if okay. you watch 30 Netflix movies and you required that much more bandwidth, uh-huh. you would have to pay the content provider for the not the bandwidth, because there's a difference between bandwidth and the amount of data that you use.
Okay.
Right? So bandwidth is the size of the pipe, right?
Got it.
Right. Whereas the amount of data that you use, which is the 30 versus 1, right, you would pay for that additional the size or the amount of data that you use to that internet service provider. So that
okay.
part doesn't change, right? What changes is the regulation on the size of the pipe, right? So for example, if you wanted to watch on your family share plan Netflix on 3 phones at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Versus me wanting to watch Netflix on 1 phone. If the vote went the other way, Netflix would be slowed down on those 3 phones,
uh-huh.
right? Because it takes up an inordinate amount of bandwidth
uh-huh.
versus just the 1. So, and let's say one of your children decided they want to watch YouTube and whatnot on your family share plan.
Right.
All that content would be segregated and slowed down. And if those providers didn't pay a premium to the internet service provider. So Netflix would have had to pay a premium to your cell phone provider, Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, pick your provider, right, to get a premium access lane so that their content wasn't slowed down or desegregated.
Mm-hmm. Well, right? maybe they'd be willing to do that though if Netflix could turn around and charge me more.
They could.
If they could create a premium tier, but now it doesn't sound like they have the option to. Is what it sounds like to me.
That's exactly
like, I think we pay. I don't know. We have the streaming Netflix subscription. I think it's $7.99 a month or something like that. I mean, maybe they would be able to create a premium stream or something and charge me $14.99 a month, or at least give me the option. And that's what the money they would use to reimburse the provider if, say, Verizon, we have Verizon Fios, wanted to charge them extra for that. If that's okay with everybody, I'm not sure I understand why they're not allowed to do that now.
Right. So what net neutrality does is it allows the big companies like Netflix that have a very large subscriber base could probably set up a tier and pay to play.
Mm-hmm.
What about that startup that's comprised of 2 or 3 people that don't have the subscribers yet but have a very innovative new service that would take up a lot of bandwidth? They can't pay the providers the amount of money that they would need because of the amount of bandwidth they'd need to consume. So their service would be degraded as compared to Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
So the winners are those little guys that are coming up with new disruptive service models, enabling innovation, allowing for a free and open internet as opposed to one where you have to pay for a specific fast lane.
So the choices then that I'm describing are still possible. It's just a matter of whether somebody wants to introduce those on top. And my sense is that what you're arguing is that this sets a floor, not sets a ceiling on the level of service it's capable.
Well, the floor is that everybody's equal on the internet pipeline. Yeah. On the internet superhighway, everyone is an equal player, right? We all have an equal footing. Netflix is just as big or just the same as your small little startup based here in Washington, D.C., right? They have the same access rights, the same privileges. Nobody gets a benefit because they can pay. Mm-hmm. Now, Netflix does have a multi-tier model to where if you want high-definition content, you can pay a little bit more, mm-hmm. right, and get that content. It'll take more bandwidth, right? So they do have that model. And these small guys could also have that model, mm-hmm. right? But because they don't have to pay an additional premium, right, to the internet service providers, their costs can be similar to Netflix costs.
I see.
Right.
I don't anticipate, David, needing the HD Netflix thing because all I really watch is Hogan's Heroes. But I'm wondering if there's anything else that I'm missing in this net neutrality discussion that will help clarify where this is all going.
No, I think you pretty much got it, Francis. It is a question of bandwidth, and it's a question of who's going to pay for the infrastructure that the users want. And the service providers are saying, we're having to invest millions of dollars. This clearly ought to be a situation where if you want a lot more access to our pipe, mm-hmm. then you ought to pay for it. In essence, it's kind of like the radio advertising model. If I want to advertise on your program or on Tom's program in the morning, I'm going to pay more for that advertising and access to that airspace than I would in the middle of the day as a typical rule. Now, I don't know what mm-hmm. the advertising rates are, but there's
on my show, very cheap.
Very cheap at any price,
yeah,
right? But there is a greater demand, and the service providers wanted to pass that along and pay a premium. Or if you clog it up, then we're going to slow you down mm-hmm. in favor of other people who will. And the FCC has said that is not the direction we're going to go. So
my sense is that we've not heard the last of this.
We haven't.
That I think we all three agree on.
Anil's choice is the most important federal news story of the week is a timeline on the FCC's net neutrality vote. You can find a link to that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week is selected by David Olive to wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Anil Carmel and by David Olive. And David, your choice at number one is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is House GOP Weighs New Approach on Homeland Security. And as we sit here on Friday afternoon, it's not looking good. I mean, the vote in the House is proceeding, and we're getting dramatically close to 218 votes for, but we're getting closer to 218 votes against as the votes wind down. There's nothing we can do about it, and there's no sense of being able to tell what's what. What we do know for sure is if we don't have a bill in place that the Senate can pass and the president can sign by midnight tonight, Homeland Security Department starts to shut down tomorrow, and we will start to really notice the effects of it on Monday. What does all of that mean to somebody like you who has so much time and experience tied up in DHS from the very beginning of the agency?
Well, the first thing is that roughly 30,000 people out of 230,000 people roughly in the Department of Homeland Security will be furloughed. They will be off work. The other 200,000 are in positions where they are either deemed essential law enforcement operations, basically carrying a gun and have a badge, or they are in agencies that are funded through fees. So USCIS, for example, which is the target of most of the wrath of the House Republicans who don't like what the president did back in November on the immigration executive action are saying, don't fund that program. Well, it's going to go on and be funded anyway because it's funded through fees.
Mm-hmm.
So the only power they have is over those areas which are not, which are funded through the general appropriations. The current CR runs out tonight at midnight. If there's no no appropriation, then everybody's laid off, and they will stay in that position until Congress starts back up.
Mm-hmm.
It means that there are no contracting officers doing work. It means that there are three or four people in the Science and Technology Directorate so that all R&D stops. Secretary Johnson, I think at the press conference you or Jason attended, laid out a laundry list of what it means, including efforts to promote the cyber security information sharing that Anil talked about earlier, because all of those people would deem to be non-essential from a law enforcement and national security standpoint.
I think it's remarkable, Anil, that we saw Secretary Ridge and Secretary Chertoff there, two of the secretaries of Homeland Security under President Bush, at this news conference with Secretary Johnson, saying this is not how you fight this battle. And as we're seeing by the vote tally this afternoon, doesn't seem to be resonating with anybody, with enough people, I guess, to keep the agency open.
Yeah, sadly, it's not. And, unfortunately, the folks that are going to pay are the people that are in public service,
mm-hmm.
The ones that are actually in the agency today that are caught in the middle, wanting to serve in a public role, safeguarding our nation and our ports, that will continue to do so. 200,000, as David mentioned, of the 230,000 employees, with 30,000 of them being furloughed beginning Monday. Our public servants will continue to serve,
mm-hmm.
but unfortunately, they're the ones that are caught in the middle.
I will say I've been more optimistic than it appears I should have been throughout this week in particular. As all of the various things happened, we would see the chain of events and I would go to the various things that could happen that would make something work. And as we sit here this afternoon with the vote tally being closer to 218 on the nays than on the yays, I'm not sure how to respond to it, to be honest with you.
My sense is, Francis, is that there were at least 30,194 people who shared your optimism.
Yes.
And it doesn't look like it's going to come to pass.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So the agency would shut down on at midnight tonight, 30,000 people not going to work, and the rest of them not getting paid. I'm not sure I understand why that's a good idea. That's a rhetorical.
I hope you're not looking for anybody in this room to answer.
No, I'm not. I'm kind of at a loss because we have hashed over what this would mean and what the implications are so much, and we have just as comprehensive coverage on a topic as I've ever seen on federalnewsradio.com about all of the implications for this. With former acting deputy secretaries of DHS talking about what this means, people who went through this in the 2013 shutdown at DHS and explaining the implications of it. We've had the coverage of what this means for cybersecurity and all of the items there that DHS leads, David.
So I think you're exactly right, and the audience that you and Federal News Radio address are people who work inside the Beltway or work for inside the Beltway entities.
Mm-hmm.
When you get outside the Beltway, it is hard to grasp the anger in the American populace mm-hmm. at what President Obama did immediately after the November elections when he put forth the executive action and said, I don't care that the Democrats got beat in the November election. I'm the president. This is what I'm going to do. And most of the people that support the folks who are now voting against the continuing resolution hear from their constituents that it's time for Congress to stand up and assert its role in a three-tier government. I think that's what they're saying. Now, I disagree with it. Good people are going to be hurt. It makes no sense to me, but that's what we've got. And now Sioux 17 against. Now they're at the magic number on the no side.
Yeah,
somebody will probably get a new job as the whip counter.
Yeah, we're going to have the latest details on this on federalnewsradio.com all weekend long. We will not stop our coverage for the weekend. The very latest details all weekend. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by David Olive. House GOP weighs new approach on Homeland Security. You can find it and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Gentlemen, thank you very much for a great countdown. David, it's great to see you as always.
Thank you.
Anil, wonderful. Thank you for coming on the countdown this week. And I want to say a special happy birthday to my son, Francis III, who turns 15 years old today. It's a big day in our house, and congratulations to him. Federal News Countdown returns next Friday on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio.